fungi, we think of mould on bread and cheese, baking, yeast, mildew, the ugly sort of mushrooms that pop up in the lawn after rain, ringworm, athlete's foot. They're members of the family with some very nasty siblings, and it's a big family. There are 6 million fungus species. This headline in Scientific American is a good starting point for this next discussion. Deadly fungi are the newest emerging microbe threat all over the world. These pathogens apparently already kill 1.6 million people every year, and we have few defences against them. So there is the issue, and to discuss it with us is a Stanford University epidemiologist, Dr. Tom Chiller, Associate Director of Global Programs at the US National Center for Emerging Infectious and Zoonotic Diseases. Hello, Tom.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here for sure.
Nice to talk to you. The headline in Scientific American, which I've just mentioned, is scary. And we should be worried by fungi?
Fungi are pretty amazing and complex organisms. There are somewhere around 5 million species. It's made up an entire kingdom of organisms. And maybe 1,000 of those we actually know by name, and only a couple hundred cause human disease. So number one, there's a lot of potential there. Number two, they've been around a long time and they know how to survive, know how to adapt. We're worried about these. They're complex, they're slow growing, but they know how to survive.
You're in charge of the divisions that monitor, or the division that monitors threats from fungi. Well, I'll say it your way, actually, fungi, like molds and yeasts and so on.
Yes, I am the chief of the mycotic diseases branch. That's the formal name here at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so we're a small group of about 35 or so people, but we're one of the few places in the world that does fungal public health. And so we're actually quite busy.
You received a report, Tom, back when COVID was taking hold in America and getting all the attention, an internal report about what was happening in hospitals near Los Angeles. What was happening?
Well, there was concern based on the fact that many of the fungal organisms that cause infections cause them in patients that are already hospitalized and are getting health care. But the particular episode you're referring to is from a fungus that is newly emerged, newly within the past decade, called Candida auris. And the challenge with this particular fungal organism is that it spreads pretty rapidly in healthcare settings, and it's highly resistant to a lot of the fungal medicines that we use to kill these fungi. And so we were certainly concerned when we heard about a cluster of these infections.
You knew about Candida auris better than anyone else in the United States, I think, but until then it hadn't arrived in the US. What is it exactly, besides being a fungus?
Yeah, so Candida auris is another one of these interesting emerging fungal species that really jumped over a couple gaps or maybe hurdles that fungi hadn't done in the past. So the Candida species, there are many different Candida species, and these are fungi that are in our intestines, in our gastrointestinal tract. And we live with them every day, and they're actually friends. I mean, they help us digest foods, etc. But what can happen, there can be an imbalance, and the Candida species in our gastrointestinal tract can actually spill out into our bloodstream. And this especially happens when you're in the intensive care and you're being treated with antibacterials. And so you're killing all the bacteria, and all that's left in your GI tract are fungi. And you can get a bloodstream infection from Candida, and we call this candidemia. The real difference with Candida auris is it's not in your GI tract. It's on your skin. These Candida are actually spreading within the hospital setting to other people in these facilities, in these hospitals, in these long-term care facilities, and causing these type of bloodstream infections, then being very challenging to treat. So Candida Oris changed the paradigm. It became not an auto infection. It became an infection that was spread in healthcare settings. And it became very hard to treat because these organisms already have resistance to some of the only known therapeutic agents. And there are only really three classes of antifungal agents that we can use to treat these candida infections with.
And we were warned about this infection from Candida auris getting into our healthcare back in 2019 in New Zealand. It was reckoned to be on the way, and it was in Australia already then. But it's hard to diagnose, I'm told.
Yes, I think it's hard to diagnose, but the fact that you guys were made aware and that the health authorities there are thinking about it, that's the first step in identifying it. It's thinking that it might be there, and then you can go looking for it. And I think one of the things that we've really improved worldwide over the last 5 years is our ability to identify it, diagnose it, and then manage it. So it's good news to know that your health authorities are aware and they're thinking about it.
But there's also very bad news, isn't there, Tom? Because what happens when a fungus like this manages to infiltrate healthcare? It's not like a superbug. It can be truly catastrophic in terms of what you have to do to defeat it.
Yeah, we've had some really challenging situations with this one. We still aren't clear on where it came from. And it sort of came out of nowhere on multiple continents. And again, the thing about it is, it really thrives in situations where we generally don't see organisms thriving in. It resists the typical disinfectants, all the disinfectants that we're using for COVID, which kill viruses and bacteria quite well, don't work against this fungus. And so in essence, you're spreading the fungus around while you kill other things. And that's been the real challenge, to identify where it is. And then you have to step up. You have to step up your disinfection protocols. You've got to use agents that are strong in bleach to be able to get rid of this in the environment. Because if you don't get rid of it in the environment, it's just going to spread to more people.
Because I was reading some hospitals where it landed had to rip out equipment and walls to get rid of it.
Yes, and in fact, there was a hospital in London that actually shut down its ICU for a number of months, just trying to mitigate and get rid of it out of the environment.
We're talking with Dr. Tom Chiller, and you wondered early on, didn't you, about that intersection of COVID and Candida, and in fact, it happened.
We've been concerned really from the outset of this about secondary infections, and fungi find that niche very easily. They like to get in when the body is not defending itself well. They are opportunists. And so not only Candida was I worried about, but I was worried about a few other mold species, aspergillosis, which is an infection caused by aspergillus, and then mucormycosis, something that's been in the news recently because of the problems they're having in India with
it. Fungi are surging beyond the climate zones they usually live in. They're adapting to environments they once didn't like. They're even learning new behaviors.
Yeah, it's a competitive environment out there. So fungi are in that environment and they're competing with other fungi, bacteria, viruses, organisms to dominate, to survive, or at least to manage. And so as the environmental changes occur, certain species just can't handle the increasing or decreasing temperatures and the changes in the soil. And fungi learn to adapt, or maybe they simply were there waiting, lurking, and then came bubbling up as the environment changed and gave it an uninhabitable environment for other organisms. So we're really just trying to learn and understand how this is happening. But clearly we've seen fungi in places where they didn't exist before, certain species, and we know some of the geographic ranges of these organisms that were classically in certain areas have spread. Some of the largest creatures on Earth, some of these underground fungi and pathogens and things we enjoy, like mushrooms that we eat and that we brew beer, with. So there's such a variety that, things that happen in the fungal world never really surprise me. And so species jumping or species changing its characteristics are definitely not something I'm surprised by. But when I see this happen, when it's a movement toward being more pathogenic, or as we say, virulent in a human being, that's the concern we have in public health. So just like coronavirus and changes in variants that are going to occur, there's going to be new variants. The more infections that are out there, the more chances that these viruses have to divide and multiply, you're going to see mutations, you're going to see variants. We're going to see the same thing in fungi. And I just think they're more apt to be able to survive on their own for a while before they actually infect us. And so we got to stay out in front.
Are we out in front at the moment? There are possibly 300 million people infected with fungal diseases worldwide, and the death toll higher than malaria, maybe rivaling tuberculosis. So are we out in front, Tom?
You know, that's a great question. I think we are sometimes on the back foot when it comes to fungi, because we can't stop breathing. And we know that breathing right now, you are inhaling fungal spores. But I think thankfully these fungal spores that you're inhaling right now, as we do this interview, they're not infecting you. Your body gets rid of them. So really the challenge here is being able to figure out how we can continue to resist the fungal organisms with our natural immunity and our own defenses. And when that fails us because we've been in a hospital or we've had to have surgery, we need to be there ready to diagnose a fungal infection and treat it as urgently as we can.
But they, as you say, exploit damaged immune systems, and we've developed medicines that suppress immunity to keep people alive and treat lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. So this has become a two-edged sword.
You know, you're absolutely right. And this is certainly the things that we worry about, is the more we manipulate our own immune systems, probably for the good of the patient ultimately, but we do then put those patients at risk, sometimes for very long periods of time, for these potentially deadly fungal infections. And it's certainly a fine line we often have to walk.
Okay, but as you say, you and I are talking, and as we're doing so, and all the listeners are listening, we are inhaling fungal spores. I read about 1,000 a day. So is that going to become more problematic? Because it was thought we had protection because of our warmth, our core temperatures, higher than a fungus can tolerate. But that may no longer be correct, or becoming incorrect.
You know, I know what you're referring to, and you're referring to some interesting data to say that the human body, that the human core temperature is dropping by maybe a degree Celsius over the past 50 years. And if that's the case, there is some arguments that have been made that part of the reason we are able to fend off these pathogens is because they are happier at room temperature, not at the body temperature. So they're happier at 25 degrees Celsius, whereas our bodies are at 37. And so our bodies fight these off. And what we are seeing, and Candida auris is a perfect example of this, is we're seeing these temperature tolerant organisms. And Candida auris likes to grow at a slightly higher temperature than do a lot of its other brothers and sisters that are the other Candida species. And so we wonder then, is that why this is emerging? Is there some temperature tolerance issue? Again, very speculative at this moment, but certainly something interesting to be thinking about and to be looking into further.
I know it's not your area, but just briefly, why are we seeing, or might we be seeing, human cooling?
You know, I don't think I have a real speculative answer for that one, Jim. So, I mean, it's a great question, and I would only be speculating, I think, if I was saying anything right now.
No, fair enough. But just as we've disturbed the habits of bats and pangolins and creatures that viruses may emerge from, we've also invaded the fungal world.
There are definite now, you know, areas where fungi were living in soils and environments that are now being disturbed by expansion of cities or construction. You're inhaling these spores because you're disturbing the soil. So we certainly know that these sort of activities are causing us to come into more contact with fungi than maybe we had in the past. And again, because we're also potentially more susceptible, it's a double-edged sword.
And you and I aren't talking about theoretical situations or even just hospital settings, are we? I was reading about the contact with the wild cats of Rio de Janeiro. So that is an example of what can happen, what is happening more and more, presumably, Tom, throughout the world.
Yeah, the interesting story that you're referring to is about a new species of a fungus called Sporothrix. And there have been Sporothrix around for a while. The classic organism was called Sporothrix schenckii. And this is what we used to refer to, and still do refer to, as the gardener's disease, because it was often a gardener would prick his or her finger on a rose or, you know, on a spine, and then would get an infection under the skin that would go up the arm a little bit and would get red and was annoying. And it was fairly easily treatable, but it was a fungus. It was a fungus that actually got into the system of the arm and spread up. And what we've seen emerge over the past 15 years is a new species of this, which they've named Brasiliensis after Brazil, where it's come from. But this particular Sporothrix is actually zoonotic, as we say, in cats. So it actually infects cats very easily. It can cause an infection. It can be on their fur, in their nails, and it spreads very readily between cats. And so, because cats, as you know, especially feral cats, fight for territory a lot. And so it began really in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro and spread quite rapidly amongst the cat population, where there are probably now tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of infected cats. And what we found is, as veterinarians started trying to take care of these cats that had pretty severe lesions, the cat could simply shake its head and spray some of the fungal spores out of the lesions on their skin, and they would get into the eyes of the veterinarians and cause infections. And the reason this is different and new is because, as I mentioned before, fungal species tend to exist in the environment at 25 degrees. They're happy outside. That's where they survive and they live. When they go into human beings, there are certain organisms that we call dimorphic fungi, which means like a fungus with two faces. One face is the face that lives in the environment, and that's the infectious form. That's the form you inhale and that you get. The other face is the form that grows in our bodies. But the good news is, at least as you can, if you can see it as good news, unlike something like tuberculosis, which can spread from person to person, many of these fungal diseases, they do not spread. When they're in our body, they are no longer infectious. Here comes Sporothrix brasiliensis, spreading from a body, from a cat to another body, a human, or to another cat in this other form. And that is something that, again, is a species change that is definitely concerning.
And it wasn't just the vets, was it? It was the families who keep the cats to keep the rats at bay. They started, mothers and children and fathers too, they started to get sick.
Absolutely. And it spread quite readily. It started down more in the southern part of Brazil, but then pretty rapidly moved into the rest of the country. And now we've seen it in multiple neighboring countries. So we're certainly concerned about how it spreads, and it looks like it really dominates a feral cat population, which then causes it to spread beyond that.
So the fungal kingdom is on the move. That's not just an exaggeration. And I think from your own work, a sick rat in a container on a ship could infect a port city. There are examples like that too, aren't there?
You know, certainly a rat or a cat doesn't need a passport to travel, and they can get on they can stow away on a ship and end up in a new port. And I'm really curious and wondering myself how do you get from Rio de Janeiro to Fortaleza, two very, very disparate parts of Brazil? So, you know, is this someone bringing a cat, traveling with their cat, or is this a rat hitching a ride? I don't know. But certainly you can see that could be a real vulnerability.
We're talking with Dr. Tom Chiller. Only around 300 fungi that we know of can cause human disease so far. But you see a kind, I know this sounds like a movie plot, but you see a kind of awakening as well in things that have been around for a billion years.
Yeah, you know, I just feel like that there have been too many interesting events, you know, recently in the fungal world, and certainly seeing some of these new species emerge with resistance and with abilities to transmit differently than we've ever seen before. Does this happen every once in a while? Or is there really something changing that is pushing these fungal species into contact with us and giving them the ability to cause disease and infect us? We are used to seeing resistance to organisms because we in human medicine tend to maybe overuse an antibiotic, and we help sort of create and drive resistance. But in this case, for some of the resistance we're seeing in Aspergillus, certainly in has been described very, very well in Europe, it turns out that there are fungicides that we use on crops or on agriculture that are exactly equivalent to the same fungicide, voriconazole, that we use in humans. And because of that overlap, we're seeing that the Aspergillus is getting its resistance in the environment, in the community, but then you're inhaling it, and then when you get sick with it and you come to the hospital, you're actually presenting now with a resistant organism that you acquired from the environment.
And the other point is that a lot of us in modern society don't have enough resistance. I mean, weakened immune systems are presumably a lot more common than they used to be because medicine keeps people alive. So we're talking about a lot of human beings at risk, aren't we?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, we are clearly creating more susceptible individuals every day. And it's partly because we're doing a better job in medicine. Our advances in medicine are phenomenal. But at the same time, there are consequences to that. And certainly keeping people alive with very weakened immune systems puts them at risk for these infections. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
How long before the problems get so serious, Tom, that we may start to need vaccines? Because I've seen this discussed.
Yes, I mean, you know, there have been efforts in the past to make a fungal vaccine. It's been surprisingly very challenging. And maybe because these are much more complex organisms, and so stimulating an immune response that actually is able to fight them off has been more challenging. But I do think we may get there. We have two potential candidates right now that are getting a lot closer than I've ever seen. Certainly vaccinating at-risk people and being able to take that off the table as a possible infection that they may get seems like a great way forward. And I always tell people, and I work at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it's really hard to prevent fungal infections, right? Because you're inhaling these fungi, you're exposed to them, they're outside, they're in the environment, you can't really hide from them. And so our job really at CDC is not necessarily to prevent in this case, which normally we would do with a vaccine, but it's to diagnose as early as possible before much damage is done and then get them on the appropriate treatment.
I don't want to sound like the voice of doom, but you are apprehensive. I mean, we mightn't want to think about this with COVID and everything else we have to think about, Tom, but maybe days of reckoning with fungi aren't that far away.
Well, I certainly want us to be thinking a bit of doom and gloom all the time. That's part of our job, is to be thinking about worst case scenarios. They're definitely here to stay. And I think our message partly is, hey, think fungus. If you're in the healthcare world, think fungus. Don't forget about fungi. I think people sometimes don't want to think about them. They just have very nasty outcomes. They have names that are hard to pronounce. And so we need to, I think, maybe make the topic more accessible so that people are aware of these organisms, and that we all as a community are investing a little bit more time and effort into thinking about some of these potential doom and gloom scenarios.
Well, you've shown us a new world that, as you say, most of us don't like to contemplate or don't even think about contemplating most of the time, but it's obviously a world that we're going to have to. Very good of you to talk with us, Tom. Thanks so much for this discussion.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure, and you know, look forward to talking with you all again in the future, hopefully about more illuminating and glorious topics than this. But remember, fungi are both our friends and enemies. And so there are still some very good fungi out there that really do help this planet a lot. And of course, you know, we can thank them for our beer and our wine as well.
That's right. Very good. Thanks, Tom. That's lovely.
Absolutely.
Dr. Tom Chiller.